You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
Welcome back to Golden Hour, a podcast where we celebrate Asian musicians. I'm Dave Yim.
And I'm Charlene K.
Char, what's been going on? It's been a month.
It's been a month. Yeah.
You've had a big month.
I did have a big month. I'm a Brooklynite now. I've had a lot going on since Golden Hour Fest. I am happily in my new home recording this from my basement, which is set up to be Golden Hour HQ pretty soon. Very excited about that. I'm working on my new record with my neighbor and producer, Laura Faye. They go by Arthur Moon. Check them out as well. Not Asian, but Asian ally. Excellent musician. Yes,
yeah, indeed. I've known Laura Faye for years. They're such an incredible musician. It's been amazing to see what they've been able to do with Arthur Moon. And I'm so excited that you guys are working together on your new album.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm good. You know, just enjoying this crisp fall weather.
It's finally crispy. Real crispy.
Yeah. I guess sort of on a Asian music sort of thread, this weekend, I finally finished The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. I finally got to the end of this epic
game. Big news.
It's been 5 months since I started.
Wait, why is that Asian related?
It's like the most Japanese game imaginable.
Great. Like, I know nothing about video games. So,
right. So it's a Nintendo, brand, and, you know, it rolls the credits and 99% of the names in the credits are Japanese. The 1% is like Chinese people. But it also, I think more than the original game, really sort of tapped into this Miyazakian theme, which the first one did a little bit, but between the music and just the pastoral nature of it, and even the storyline this time, I won't spoil anything, but the storyline was really strong, and there are dragons involved, and it really ends in a very beautiful, poetic way. The game itself, you know, it was pretty easy to get to the end of, if I do say so myself, but the actual storytelling I found to be really poignant and beautiful.
Wow. So that was such a good sell for someone like me who isn't a video game person, but I'm interested in some pastoral video games with good storylines.
There is fighting. There are, you know, goblin creatures that you gotta like slash, but it's not very complicated. And it's kind of like cartoony violence, but there are some dark themes in there. You like go deep underground and there's like, you know, the undead, there's a demon king. Oof. It's quite a thrill ride.
How Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So I'm, you know, but of course with this game, I've beaten the game, but there's so much other side stuff that you could do. So I could be playing this game for the next year, just like doing all these little tasks. You can like build yourself a house and like all of this stuff. So that's been my exciting weekend.
I have friends that are obsessed with Zelda, so you're not alone in that. I'm sure we've got listeners who are also into it, so maybe I'll check it out and then I'll report back with my findings.
I was in an airport last weekend, and there was a guy who had a shirt that said, "I stopped playing Zelda to do this." And I said, "I need that shirt."
Oh my God. I have family members who were really into World of Warcraft. Like they were so good that they would get to a certain level and make a ton of money by selling their login information so that people could get onto the level that they were at, because it's apparently incredibly difficult to win the game. And there's a whole like black market community of people selling login informations. And they told me about a forum online called Widows of Warcraft, which is a support community for women whose marriages have ended because of World of Warcraft. Isn't that sad and hilarious. It's not funny. It is terrible.
Sad. One thing that I do like about Zelda is it's a very solitary experience. There's no multiplayer. There's no online play. So it's just like me and the Miyazakian, you know, fields ahead of me.
So what you're saying is that you and Deb have managed to maintain a very strong and communicative relationship.
Yes.
While
this has not ruined my relationship
exploring
yet.
This game. Great.
Exactly. Exactly.
We love to hear it.
Wait, do we want to do our gold star of the month?
Oh, yes. We've been internally debating this segment. We've been wanting to have a segment every show where we spotlight a particular Asian musician, not the one that we interview. And Dave's wife, Deb, had this idea to call it giving someone a golden shower. Can't not laugh.
Idea is a strong word. We'll call it a gag.
Yes, and yes. It started as a joke.
So
I loved it so much. I loved it so much that we incorporated it. And I'm actually desensitized to it now. It's not weird anymore to me. I don't feel like we're peeing on anyone anymore.
Maybe it's lost its bite. A couple other ideas I had to maybe sanitize it a little bit. We could call the section gold star. We give her gold star of the month. Golden boy, golden or golden girl or golden person of the mm-hmm. month. Also a new one. I thought we could give a golden goose to someone. Or golden goose of the month. We're still workshopping.
Yeah, very Willy Wonka. Yeah, which golden goose has laid our favorite golden egg?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe we just change it every episode.
There we go. I'm going to go with Golden Goose this month.
Yeah.
This episode,
it's Golden Goose. Next episode, you're just going to have to tune in again to find out what we change it to, or if we go back to the Golden Shower.
So I would like to give this month's Golden Goose to this Korean band called Balming Tiger. They just released their debut album, January Never Dies, last week. And I've sort of been following them for about a year. Of course, my very knowledgeable wife, Deb, was the one who introduced it to me. And the reason why I like them so much is, you know, I'm not the biggest K-pop person, which I know I'll probably get, you know, destroyed by all the stans and the armies. But it just,
like
to me, in my taste, it feels very sanitized. It's very corporate. I mean, you know, there's a literal like stock index exchange for K-pop. Like it is the most capitalist form of entertainment. And there's something about that, you know, for me, you know, you can talk, obviously they're very talented with their video production, their dancing, the music and everything. Like there's a reason why it's a global phenomenon is because it's very well crafted. But for me, Balming Tiger is the antithesis of that. There's not a plastic surgery in sight. And actually, everyone has like, everyone in the band has kind of a weird face, which I really love. They're just like very real people. And there's a punk energy to it. They define themselves as a hip hop collective. So in this collective, there's like 9 or 10 different people. There's sort of 3 or 4 main MCs, Mud the Student, Omega Sapien, Sogum are some of them. And also like there's producers that are part of it. There's also filmmakers who do all of their music videos and video editors. So it is truly like this very egalitarian sort of musical collective that speaks to all forms of artistry. And yeah, the genre, it touches on hip hop, it touches on metal a little bit, it touches on punk. And it just like, it feels very genuine. And I just love that this band exists to kind of be an antidote to what I consider to be a very sanitized K-pop world. And they're just an amazing band coming out of Korea. And I think there's a huge future for them. So shout out Balming Tiger, Golden Goose of the Month.
I love Balming Tiger. Love their new music video, their song Moving Forward. It's just, I love how playful it is. It has this very irreverent energy. It's like kind of like the Korean Odd Future, which is Tyler, the Creator's collective of folks that collaborate and appear in each other's stuff. I am a K-pop stan. And I think there's a place for everything. It's, to me, K-pop is like the Marvel of music. It's like unapologetic explosions, like extremely like high octane overwhelming sometimes and like doesn't really mean anything. But that said, I do appreciate Balming Tiger because it does seem that they're super DIY, especially their early stuff. You can tell that they just kind of walked around with the camera and did what they could. And I appreciate that scrappy fighter spirit. So congratulations, Balming Tiger, and check out their new album, January Never Dies.
Shar, do you want to introduce our guest for this month?
I would love to. All right. This artist that we are about to have this conversation with is called Noso. They are a Korean-American non-binary singer-songwriter, guitarist, producer, and composer. One of my first introductions to Noso was reading about them in NPR, in which the article had this headline that said, Noso's debut album is a care package for someone in need, their younger self. I was really moved by that, and it's clear that when you listen to their music, they are struggling with these themes of identity and sexuality and very vivid lyric writing. Growing up in the suburbs, feeling isolated is something that I feel like any Asian American who's grown up in a predominantly white neighborhood can really relate to. It's very vulnerable music with extremely creative guitar playing. That's what first captured me about it. What mm-hmm. about you, Dave? What was your first impression of Noso?
Yeah, so Noso, whose real name is Baek Hwang, one of their newest songs, Caitlin, is probably one of my favorite of theirs. It just has this really infectious acoustic guitar lick that is just like, I could just listen to it on loop forever. Mm-hmm. And their songwriting is so intimate. And we talk about sort of their role in sort of providing intimacy for someone who is non-binary, who is trans, and sort of the importance of that kind of storytelling for this, you know, sort of group of people and where Noso sees themselves within sort of that the current cultural moment being that voice. And also on some of Noso's new music, they collaborate with a mutual connection. We have Daniel Che from the band Run River North played some music. I think he did some producing on some of their new music too. And so we talk about both knowing Daniel and they had a great experience working with him. But yeah, I really love this interview. They're such a tender person and they brought so much joy and openness to this interview.
Yes, agreed. Here's a clip of Noso's most recent single, Caitlin. So without further ado, please enjoy our interview with Noso. Beck, it is so wonderful to have you on the show today. We've been fans for a long time. My introduction to your music was watching your NPR Tiny Desk concert, which it seems like a lot of people found out about you that way, which is so exciting. I was also having fun reading the comments, and so many people were like, cool, they sound exactly like they do on the record as they do live. It was such an amazing performance. I was really, really taken by your guitar playing, particularly. I'm a guitar player, and the way that you're able to play these very like nuanced arpeggios while singing a different melody over it, I thought was so gorgeous, not to mention the storytelling of your music. And it just paints a very clear picture of who you are as a person in addition to an artist in like a very short amount of time. So it's been really cool to see your journey and especially entertaining to learn that you submitted for the Tiny Desk concert yourself in 2019 and did not make it. And then here you are now having the last laugh with your own experience. Tell me about your headspace at that moment and what it felt like to be in that iconic space.
It quite honestly was a fever dream. Me and my entire band, it didn't feel real, the entire experience. It was amazing. But especially seeing the set and realizing it was genuinely an office space and that was Bob Boylan's like actual desk. It was really surreal. And especially just very sweet and full circle, because after I did the contest submission back in 2019, I was invited to open for the winner that year who's a really great artist, Quinn Christofferson. And the NPR staff was at the show in LA that I played at. And so I got to meet the staff. And
Nice.
So it was just a really sweet full circle moment.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any reflections now that you've, you know, released your debut album around this idea of like, you know, rejection as an artist and facing it, you know, the fact that you got to get to, you know, the tiny desk all these years later. Well, I guess it was only a couple of years later, you know, after having submitted and not made it, you know, I imagine as an artist in any discipline, you hear a lot of no's before you finally get a yes. I wonder if you have any reflections on that.
I think, I don't know. I feel like it's all kind of inherently part of the process. And I think oftentimes being a musician, when you lose an opportunity, or if you feel like something wasn't received in the way that you wanted with a release or anything, it just feels so personal, because it's not like you're an actor pretending to be someone else and then your performance gets scrutinized. It's being like, this is my personality, my life story, everything. Like, do you like it, you know, to the public? And so I think I've, through the years, used to take things really, really personally and feel really like, just in general with like, I think it dates back to being really competitive with getting into colleges and all these different things and all these prestigious, you know, different programs. And I think I've gotten to a place now where I just realize it's not personal, even though it feels that way. But yeah, music is funny in that sense that it's very specific, where it's very all encompassing, I feel like, compared to other art forms.
Yeah, it's really easy to take it personally when it's your soul. You're like, you're burying your soul for everyone. And it's such an interesting thing as an artist myself, when I was like submitting to all these blogs and stuff, when blogs were more instrumental in establishing a platform for you, you could get feedback if you wanted to sometimes, which was terrifying. And I realized that I had accidentally hit the like, yes, I'd like feedback button. And the person who was managing the blog, the song that I had written was about sexual assault. And it was like this white guy who was like running the blog. And he was like, well, I'm not going to post this because I don't really relate to it. And I was like, of course you don't relate to it. Oof. You haven't had the experience that I've had. And so it was just, it is hard to take it personally at times, but then you're like, I'm not for everybody. I'm especially being a minority and a woman and somebody who like has had experiences of reduction like that. That's something that if you find your community and you find your people, that's the most important thing. And it seems like you've found such a devoted following of other non-binary trans folks who gravitate towards your authenticity. And that should be the only thing that you care about.
Yeah. I think it was kind of healing in a way, the album campaign, just because playing these shows, it was really some of the first times that I really saw people who looked really similar to me in audiences, was at my own shows, because I feel like in the indie music scene, it's, you know, predominantly white at a lot of spaces that I don't feel entirely welcome in a lot of the time. And so, yeah, I think it was just all around a really healing experience getting to tour, and hear people's stories about how they relate to the music and why. So yeah.
I'm sure it was healing for them too.
Yeah. How has the experience of tour been? Because, you know, I feel like this summer of 2023 feels like the first big year when like touring is back, from like coming out of the pandemic. Obviously we've had, you know, the big ones, the Taylor Swifts and Beyonce's, which I was lucky enough to go to. But also, you know, indie acts and, you know, all the rest of the music world is back too. You know, how has it been sort of like getting back into the swing of touring and doing live shows?
It's been interesting. I think my first experiences with touring was only in a post-COVID landscape, because prior to that I was in college. And so my experiences have always been, you know, keeping things really safe and going with people who have are from a similar mentality, and being like, taking care of your health is the first priority. And so I've been really lucky in that I've traveled with really great artists that I opened for and had really good experiences. And I think I've had really positive experiences with touring. There's obviously the really difficult aspects of it in terms of mental health and how debilitating that can be. But I think given all things considered, I've been really, really lucky with the different opportunities I've had, and I think the company that I've had while traveling.
Are there any particular performances that stick out, people that you've met, conversations that you've had after the show?
On my first tour, I opened for a band called Yumizuma in, on the East Coast, and that was my very first pretty much real experience with touring, and I had such a good time. It really set the bar in terms of, it was kind of a solidifying experience where I was like, oh, I can do this, because there are so many, even though there are difficult aspects of the lifestyle, there are so many moments that make it worth it. And when you travel with kind people, and it just, yeah, that sticks out as a very special experience for me, just because I was so terrified of really even in a way following through with the career path that I chose, just because the entire concept of touring was very frightening to me.
It's frightening to me now.
Yeah, Charlene toured quite extensively for a number of years, and you kind of got burned out on it, right, Char?
Yeah, I mean, I'm older too. When you said that the only experiences that you've had of touring has been post-pandemic because you were in college before, I went, wow. Because it's so recent, and it is a completely new ball game. It's a little bit like a Wild West right now with what touring is, because streaming didn't exist when I was beginning to tour, and it was like you'd haul CDs around and stuff. People still sleep on each other's couches and stuff, but I did my first tours when I was in college, and it was like, it was kind of like you were saying, it's very clear that the hang is more important, if not just as important as the ability to play, because you're in the van and you're interacting with these people for 90% of the day, and then 10% of the day you're actually playing. But yeah, how do you keep yourself well on tour? And are there practices that you have before shows? Is there a way that you're able to like maintain your mental health and your balance while you're in a different city every day and like being very disoriented by time zones and stuff like that?
I think I've definitely learned some lessons. I think on my first US tour, I felt a lot of pressure to sell merch afterwards and interact with a lot of different people, because I really enjoy that part of the process and getting to hear people's stories. And I've heard people traveling for shows and things like that. But I think I lost my voice for the last show. And it was really, it was really scary. And I think things like that, it was a learning lesson, you know, even though I'm tempted at times to be like, of the mentality of being like, I need to do this. I have to push myself because, you know, I'm here, I'm doing so much. But I think it affected the show. And so I think that was a really good, I think it showed me that I needed to have some more boundaries for myself, even if there are people telling me I have to do this, quote unquote, or do that. And I think just in general, I mean, I think growing up, a lot of the media that I consumed that were about touring, it was a very hectic and chaotic lifestyle in terms of there were a lot of substances and there was a lot of, and so my parents were really scared for me to become a musician because of that, and they imagined that's the only way like my lifestyle was gonna look. But I don't drink and I don't do anything, and so pretty much my tours are really wholesome, and I just go home. I don't know how people, even if I didn't, I don't really know how people have the energy after shows to just go out, because I'm drained. And then, so I just go back and watch reality TV.
And I think that being straight edge is like the new punk.
Like, I think so.
I mean, I'm in my 30s, but I also don't drink, and I never did when I was on tour. And I feel very similarly. I was like, it's not even the performance, it's the talking to people after the show that's the most difficult, because you're like, hey, nice to meet you, and you're like kind of speaking in like a higher register because there's a bar with like people talking that you have to like cut through, and it's a lot of social energy too. You have to like you want to connect and you want to have an authentic moment with people. And it's also a different aspect of yourself that you're giving in addition to the creative performance that you've given.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I think people have really great intentions when they want to speak to the artist after. And I want to speak to people. It's just that I need to play a show the next day and I don't know if I can. I spend the whole night talking over blasting club music.
Yes.
So it's difficult to strike a balance for those kinds of things, I think. But yeah, I'm kind of just learning as I go.
Yeah. Well, what a cool thing that people will wait for you to, and talk and want to talk to you and feel the need to show up for you like that in those spaces.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful thing, and I really like value those experiences. Yeah, just like singing and sound check and my voice just stopping was really scary. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.
I wanted to ask a question sort of on this theme of like community, right? And balance between serving a community and society at large and sort of your role as an artist. I think artists who are trans right now have like a really sort of important role in, you know, obviously in the political climate, it's very fraught. There's a lot of sort of like, you know, negativity. I mean, there's actual laws being passed in a lot of Republican-led states around trans rights and things like that. And there's a lot of demonization happening too, right? Like the whole like grooming stuff and all of this like crazy thing where they, you know, the LGBT community is just like, you know, painted as this like, you know, demonic force. And I think something that your music in particular does so well is it humanizes your experience as an individual, but an individual who is also trans. And I think by telling your stories, you're humanizing it in a way that is really important right now to show the world. So I'm wondering how you see your role as an artist who is trans and non-binary to sort of show society what the trans experience is and humanize it versus like, no, I'm just going to tell my story, you know, and I'm an individual. I'm going to share my story. And, you know, whatever you get out of that, you get out of that. I'm wondering, or do you see them sort of balancing each other out?
I think what's interesting is I didn't really come to terms with being trans really until the campaign started rolling out, because prior to that, when I was writing the songs, I knew that I obviously had a really difficult relationship with gender identity because I had surgery, but I still wasn't even willing to admit that I was trans. And I think now that there've been, I think there's an audience that comes to my shows that I don't think I would have reached had I not been honest about my identity, I think naturally throughout the course of the campaign. But I think in a lot of ways, I always thought that just who I am was possibly too niche to appeal to people beyond, you know, people who are just like me. But then I think at my London show, there was a guy who's prefaced what he was saying by being like, I'm a cis straight white dude, but your song Parasites, which is about top surgery, he was like, that's the song that like really got me through a difficult time. And I think that was kind of one moment where I realized there was kind of an overlying theme to the songs that I had, even though I felt in my eyes that it was too niche to be, you know, to be registered by other people outside of the community. But I think it is just themes of just isolation and loneliness and searching for a place to feel like you're seen and like you belong. And I think anyone can relate to that.
Yeah, it just goes to show that the more personal you get with your work and the more open you are with specific details of what you went through, the more universal it ultimately is.
Mm-hmm.
It's this strange thing of just like, the more personal and specific, also the more universal and the more open it becomes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I went to music school and had a really good experience there, but very much our songwriting classes were kind of the focal point of the conversations were being like, you have to be as universal as possible. And they were like, a lot of the professors I had were actually like, you shouldn't be too personal. Like, you have to just sum it up in one line that everyone can relate to. And I never really agreed with that kind of mindset because I was like, that's already been said so many times. There's only so many times you can say like, I miss you, like, I love you. It's like, there are so many different ways to say that. And the more personal you are, like what you're saying, it's almost more universal as opposed to being vague, you know, and ambiguous.
Yeah, I think there's also a parallel to the Asian American experience too. I work in sort of like a film and documentary world a lot. And I think there's a movement happening of sort of this understanding that like, you know, stories of the Asian diaspora, you know, for many years, it sort of felt like, oh, you know, America won't understand, you know, my story because, you know, I'm a child of immigrants. And that was sort of cast on us in a way of like, only people who experienced that will understand. So like, you know, you can only tell stories that have that quote universal, which in a large, you know, it sort of in a way it's coded of being like, tell stories that are like white and cis and heteronormative and like fall into a certain thing. Like that was what was universal, right? Whereas like, who's to say that, you know, the queer Asian experience is not also universal, right?
Mm.
So I think, you know, there's sort of this, you know, you can make a parallel between the Asian American experience being quote unquote niche as well as the queer experience.
Yeah, totally. I think, I feel like in the media recently, there's been so many different projects that have resonated universally. I feel like that's, you know, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, Past Lives recently. There's just been so many different stories about specific immigrant experiences as well that are also, I mean, there's a queer storyline in Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I think it's just, yeah, it's very exciting for me just as someone who consumes that media and watches. I feel like when I was growing up, it didn't seem possible for me to be able to see a story on screen where I was like, oh, I see people who look like me and also stories that are similar to mine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing about universality, right? Is like, I don't know, superhero movies are like, you know, Marvel stuff is the most popular, but it's like, who can identify with like, you know, oh, I invented a suit and now I can like fly around and blast bad guys. So it's like, what is...
I mean, speak for yourself.
You know, it's like... Yeah, I think the universality thing is just like a coded way of just like minimizing people's experiences who aren't of the quote unquote mainstream.
Yeah, especially if it was like a pop music class.
Yeah, I mean, I loved my experience there. And there were a lot of, I think I had some really good advice and some other advice that I don't know if I would execute.
It's like we were talking about like, oh, is this too, am I too niche? Mm-hmm. Is my experience too isolated to relate to other people? I was reading an interview of yours, Beck, before coming on this call, and you had this great line that I wrote down that said, you said, I was writing something and I thought, oh, this is a bit melodramatic, but I felt every single line and every single line was true.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that a lot as well when I'm writing things, and I always feel like I'm being hyper emotional and like no one's ever been heartbroken before, and like it feels like the reason that we're artists is because we have these big dramatic feelings. But when I listen to your music, I would never imagine that it's too dramatic, because that is how I feel too.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet that so many people listening to your music and anyone who loves art turns to it because they've had a moment where they're like, I'm too much, I'm acting, I'm hurting too much. I'm like being too messy. I'm being too difficult and stuff like that. But that is why we turn to music, like the songs that you write. And I was telling Dave before we interviewed you that one of my favorite songs of yours is Everything I've Got, because it's so heartbreaking, and it's particularly about queer and trans love, but it's so universal. It doesn't have to be about that particular relationship because it transcends your experience, and it speaks to all different people's experiences as well. The lyric, "If I was born fairly, I'd be him," breaks my heart. I was wondering if you could talk about that song a little bit and what it means to you and the process of writing that.
Yeah, that quote I said was, I think, actually about that song, how when I look back on it, I wrote it when I was 20. And so I think there's something about also just the Asian American experience that informs minimizing your own feelings, probably because the culture just kind of represses all emotions and refuses to discuss emotions. And so I think,
absolutely,
I've been, as I've gotten older, trying to break out of that mentality. And so I think me minimizing my experiences to being like, I'm being so dramatic, this is too much, also comes from just that heritage, you know, that aspect of me. And I think with that song particularly, it was very different in that the guitar is really simple, and I used to really hide behind intricate guitar parts so that I could kind of distract from being too vulnerable. And I think that song was a bit of a breakthrough where I was like, oh, I don't have to be playing riffs, I don't have to be so like trying to prove that I'm a musician on every single song. Sometimes like the focus of the song could be my voice, even though I'm self-conscious, you know, of what I'm singing about. And I think when I look back on it, and especially when I perform it, I have moments of feeling resentful, of being like, God, why did I write such an intense song? But I think when I look back on it, it is still like what I was saying, I was like, no, that's exactly how I felt. Even if it, in hindsight, like 6 years later, after I've healed from the situation, can think it's funny now, or just you know, not be in the thick of it like I was back then, it's like it did help me at some point.
Nice. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned your sort of Asian American heritage, specifically Korean American. Mm-hmm. So the name Noso, I read, comes from North and South in a reference to the two Koreas. I didn't read in that line exactly what it came from, but my take, and I want to hear what, you know, where you came from, it was this idea of, you know, the two Koreas being of these two identities, right? They're sort of split, and they're two very different places that are a one people, but they are in sort of two very different realities. So that was sort of what I was thinking, or how it sort of spoke to me around your name and a lot of the themes that you touch upon. But yeah, I would love to hear how you came up with that name and sort of what it meant for you.
That's actually a lovely take. I think the wonderful man who wrote my bio, accidentally did North/South instead of North or South. And so there's been a misconception that I'm talking about Korea as a whole and the two countries and the contentious relationship between the countries, but I'm not. It's because I grew up in a predominantly white town. And so people would always ask me North or South whenever I said I was Korean. And so I would have to try and argue as a child, essentially, of being like, I'm not from North Korea. Jesus. And so it's just me reclaiming that very specific part of my life. And also it has carried through even as an adult. People still ask me things like that. And so I think it's just kind of a cheeky way of poking fun back, you know, something that used to really bother me. Now I'm like, you're so stupid, you know?
That's incredible. Wow. Good for you for taking that back for yourself.
Yeah. I was originally going to go under North or South, but I felt like that was going to be too on the nose. And my dad is the one who suggested Noso.
I like Noso.
Yeah.
I want to ask a little bit about sort of your production. You know, I was going back through your discography, and your first single in 2018, Alley, has this kind of very like rootsy, four on the floor, kind of beat, a lot of like jangly acoustic guitars. And then on your album, Stay Proud of Me, there's a lot of experimentation going on, a lot of really interesting production, some sort of like 80s sort of new wave reference, some like big ballad stuff. Like, you know, you really sort of like stretch of, you know, where you touch, and it speaks to the song and songs, and everything seems so intentional. But then also on your most recent single, Caitlin, you kind of go back to that sort of like folk rootsy sort of vibe. Yeah, so I'm just wondering about your production process, I guess, early on during the album, and then sort of where you are now.
Yeah, back then I worked with a producer named Wolfie, who's an amazing person, amazing musician. And I think I didn't really have a great concept of who I was just in general. And also as an artist, I think I would just send tracks and be like, I want to sound like this, you know? And I think they nailed it. I actually really love the production on that song. And I really held off on learning how to produce for a long time because I was just, I had some like internalized misogyny going on at the time. And I think I just felt like, oh, I can't produce. Someone else will just do it for me. And then through the campaign and through demoing, I was like, this is taking so long. I need to learn how to do this. And I think the first song that I produced was Suburbia. And that was kind of a turning point where I was like, oh, this is a form of songwriting, because I would never have been able to write this if it were just me on guitar. And so that opened up a whole new palette where I was like, oh, I can write an entire track and then sing over it. Like I'm a hip, like kind of the way that hip hop, you know, artists create songs. And so ever since then, I kind of fluctuate between if one starts to feel trite, like playing on guitar all the time, then I'll go and make a track first and sing over it. So half the album was written that way, where it's like Honey Understand, Parasite, Suburbia. And there's a couple others where I built the track first and sang over it. And then other songs like I Feel You, Everything I've Got are very much more in the singer-songwriter kind of, you know, just because it was just me and a guitar. And Caitlin was just me and a guitar. So I think it's just the way that I write can sometimes inform the production.
Yeah, my first introduction to your music video catalog was the song David, which also sticks out to me lyrically because there's, you're singing about this white dude named David with a pointy nose that all the girls want and who is serene and blank in your, Hoppa Dave is pointing his pointy nose. And I was laughing because when I was younger, I would sit there in class and I would pinch my nose like this because all I wanted was to have like a more Caucasian looking nose, which just seems to, Sundial has a song about that too. I was like, wow, this is not, this is an aspect of the Asian experience that I thought I was alone in, but again, the personal is universal.
Yeah, because there was also, just a quick aside, there was, what is that Hulu show about, seventh grade.
Oh, Pen 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pen 15.
Yeah.
There's a scene where she's like in the mirror, like playing with her eyes. And like, I've done that at middle school, but because I'm mixed race, I also ended up with a really like British big nose that doesn't look Asian at all. So I sort of like, you know, I have a combination of features. So like the nose thing is like, well, I can't identify with that part of the Asian American experience, but the eye thing, I guess I can identify with that part.
Yeah. So you're on your own confused journey.
Yeah, no, exactly. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay. That lyric just resonated with me so much. And I was wondering if you could talk about that song and what it means to you.
Yeah, that was, I basically had a dream where most of my dreams I can see my own body, but for some reason this dream I was in like the body of a white dude, and I was in a church sitting in a pew, and I saw the way that people perceived me and looked at me, and especially like white women, which I feel like was such, I had such a conflicted relationship with just my heritage while growing up in a predominantly white town and constantly trying to seek the validation of people around me, that I got really emotional when I woke up because I was, at that time, I had been learning Korean and I felt like I was trying to get closer to my culture after so many years of resenting it. And I think I just woke up being like, all of this work I've done, like all of this feeling of pride I've had is just like down the toilet. Like, what's going on? Why would I have a dream like that? And I think I just had to learn to just be like kind of gentle to myself because I was like, I spent 16 years in a town like that of being bullied. So of course I'm going to have like subconscious thoughts like that that are going to pop up of being like, oh, I wish it was just simple, you know? And so when I wrote that song, I had a really conflicted relationship with it because I was like, this is too, like, it's so happy sounding. This is not a happy topic. You know, what if people think that I'm trying to like make a joke out of a situation like this, or it's like, I'm trying to beat people to the punchline and make jokes about the Asian American experience. But then I've come to just accept it and being like, just cause it's a pop song doesn't diminish the meaning behind it. You know, it doesn't have to be like an avant-garde orchestra to be a valid, you know, piece of music. It's okay that it's more simple. And I think, I feel like now I really stand by it and what I said in it.
Nice. Yeah. I feel like pop music can be the most powerful way to sort of like, you know, almost like hiding the medicine in the treat kind of thing of just like, you know, people get hooked on it and then they love it so much that they dig deeper into the lyrics and the storytelling. And then they say, whoa, you know, there's something here that I might not have realized at first. Whereas, you know, I guess an avant-garde song, you expect it to kind of, you know, have these kinds of deep themes, where pop music, you can kind of, yeah, you can kind of sneak the vegetables in with the candy or whatever the...
Sneak the activism in with the hooks.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
What a crazy experience to have a dream where you're perceived as the face of patriarchy.
I know.
and like be and embody it, like have people look at you with respect and desire.
It was so your nose bizarre. Is yeah.
Well, so you grew up outside of Chicago, right? I think you've said that it was pretty much a largely white majority sort of community, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Charlene and I think in a way this podcast almost feels like Asian rehab in that we also both grew up in very white sort of suburban communities, and that we're just trying to like, we're like doubling down on our Asianness. I'm just like, let's start a podcast where we just talk about Asian stuff all the time.
That's so funny because I've been learning how to make Korean food in a very traditional way, from recipes from my mom and from reading online. And so I've been making kimchi, and I wear gloves and I like, squat on the ground, and it feels like, I feel like the spirit of my, you know, of my ancestors when I do stuff like that. And I almost feel like I'm cosplaying at moments just because of the environment that I grew up in. And I have to remind myself, like, no, you are a Korean person.
It's the squatting. It's the squatting. Yeah. But then you moved to LA as a teenager, right? So mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess how has your Asian American identity or Korean American identity evolved from those early adolescent years growing up in that Chicago suburb?
Yeah, I was really, it was quite a culture shock because my new town in LA was pretty much half Asian and then half Mormon. And so my town in Chicago... Whoa. That was predominantly white. I think I harbored so much shame about my identity for so long. And then I felt like actually one of the issues was that I didn't have a lot of external validation. And I was, when you're a teenager, you kind of cling on to that. And so when I moved, that was really the first time any boys had ever expressed interest in me. And I think it's because of the environment I was in that they were exposed to people like me throughout their entire life. And so I took that as a sign of like, oh, this means I'm worth something. Like, this means I'm valuable. And so even though I knew I was gay, like I didn't want them, but I was still like, oh, this means I'm something. And so I think after that experience, being on a high from that, and when I went to USC, that was also, I had my own little bubble in the art school that was liberal, but the rest of the school was pretty conservative. And so at parties, there was a lot of racism and a lot of, again, I felt like I wasn't getting a lot of validation from these like white men that I was so like growing up, that was the only source of, in terms of socializing, everyone was seeking that. And so it was kind of like a tipsy topsy, you know, of constantly, of growing. And now that I'm in my 20s, I think I have never been more proud to be who I am. And I think I've been learning Korean on my own, and I've been kind of trying to heal my own experience with that part of my culture. And actually Daniel Che, when I hung out with him, was like, you know what? You give such Korean vibes. Like, you're so Korean to me. And that was, I was like, I can't tell you what that means to me.
As a person who knows a lot of Koreans, including my wife, I will support Daniel's notion that you give a lot of Korean vibes. I won't quantify exactly what that means, but I will say I agree with him.
I was so tickled because my entire life it was like white kids, you know, being very confused by my presence, and then my cousins being like, you're so whitewashed, you know. And so that was very healing for me. Thanks, Daniel. But then also... yeah, I think now in LA, I mean, I went to an event actually kind of recently that was, it was like a queer event. And I was feeling pretty weird about myself just because I felt like I didn't really have that communal, like the Korean queer community aspect. And so I ran into a lovely person from my past who was with a bunch of cool, you know, gay Asian people. And it felt like a sign where I was like, oh, this is what I've been searching for and what I didn't even realize I was searching for, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been a really wild journey, but I've been feeling really, really happy and really proud these days.
I'm so glad awesome. To hear that.
And you've also had a reconnection with kimchi making.
Yeah. Yeah.
And K-drama writing, which I would love to hear.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm dying to hear about this K-drama.
Yeah.
Oh, so the Korean drama, I started writing in 2020 during writer's block with the album. And I wrote 10 seasons of it, and I still do dabble. I still write it.
Okay, wait. By 10 seasons, I know. Do you mean you've written 10 episodes per season? Or is it like
so
one...
It's free
tell me,
form.
Please tell me more.
It is pretty. It's a pretty free form structure because I don't know how to write an episode, so it was just be like 1,000 pages, and I'd be like, okay, that's season one. On to the next one, wow. And I would do it every what? Single day, like all day. I don't know what was going
Can
on.
Can you tell me about the characters and the plot?
So actually,
I just love K-dramas. I love hearing about the plots of them. I love the forbidden love triangles.
Oh, I love it so much. It's pretty westernized in terms of, it's not as conservative as some of the storylines in K-dramas. Like, they're all gay. But there's a love triangle between one character and his childhood sweetheart, who's a little toxic, and then also his...
yeah, there's a love triangle somewhere.
And then there's an heiress with a heart of gold who he's also a little bit in love with, and she's also toxic. They're all toxic, but like...
There's always an heiress involved.
And they just go to a lot of parties, and they just kind of kick it. And there's so many plot holes. There's so many things that just don't make sense, and it's so fun.
So is this like an ongoing... like series that you're still just like writing?
Yeah, it's never, nothing's gonna, it's just for myself. I just write it like, if there's something going on in my life that I'm trying to grapple with, I put it as a storyline also.
Wow, so you're almost like journaling incredible. Through these like fake K-drama characters.
Oh yeah, totally.
Wow, I love that. There needs to be a K-drama therapy. I think you've just invented something where people process their emotions by inventing K-dramas and putting their own life event, like own life issues into it.
I highly recommend it. It's very cathartic.
Doesn't it It does make me feel better when I imagine like something's going wrong and I'm like, nope, I'm just in season four. Just wait until season six. Yeah. That's when the good shit happens. There's so many characters I haven't even met yet.
Yeah.
I'm also imagining a like a concept like Noso album, like albums where yes. all of these characters like come to life and you just write like albums and albums of these characters into songs.
That's actually, Honey Understand is storylines from the K-drama, because when I went back to music, there was nothing going on in my life because it was quarantined. So I was like, oh, I'll just sing from the perspective of the character in love with the heiress.
Wow, amazing.
It's amazing.
But yeah, tell us what is, I know you have one single that came out this year. What's next for the Noso project and for whatever other creative endeavors you have going on?
I do have, I'm touring Europe for the first time next month.
Amazing.
That I'm really excited for. I've been to the UK only for shows. And so a lot of these places I've never been. I've never been to Germany or Belgium or any of that. So I'm really excited. And then I've been working on the second album. A lot of the songs are about being Korean. The first one as well, but I felt like this album is a bit more like the kind of complexities of navigating relationships. I felt like the first album was a lot of childhood experiences for the most part. Mm. So this is more about me kind of as an adult. I sing in Korean a little bit. It's a little exciting. Bit, I get a little shy.
Nice. Yeah.
But yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, when you put out second album, give us a call. We'd love to have you back on the show and hear about, you know, the experience of making that one. Sounds like it'll be probably a very different experience.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, we're so honored to have had you. Thanks for being so open and vulnerable with your story.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you so much again to Noso for joining us on the show today. You can find them on Instagram at Noso Music, and their most recent album, Stay Proud of Me, is available everywhere now. Please subscribe, follow, rate the podcast on whatever platform you listen to. Your engagement really helps us make the show better. And keep buying our merch. That's the simplest way to support us. People will ask you, what's that awesome dragon shredding on your shirt? And you can tell them about the podcast. Great conversation starter, great way to flirt, etc., etc. And we're still offering our promo code AZN2023 for a special discount for pod listeners. Golden Hour is created by me and produced and edited by Dave Yim. We're proudly part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Wow, what a tongue twister. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.